everybody, you're tuning in to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. Today I have the honor and pleasure of speaking with the dually talented trombonist and vocalist Aubrey Logan, here to talk about her latest album, Where the Sunshine is Expensive, that debuted at number one on the Billboard Contemporary Jazz charts. We're super excited to talk to her. Please help me welcome Aubrey.
Hello.
Hello, Aubrey.
Hi, is this Cliff?
Yes, it is. How are you?
Hi, Cliff. I'm great. How are you today?
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you.
Yay.
Well, super excited to chat with you today on the podcast. I met you a few years ago at a Berklee alumni brunch and saw you play. And we have a lot of friends in common and stuff that we'll kind of get into. But yeah, super excited. So we're going to kind of, I guess, start from some of your latest material and then kind of work our way backwards, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's great.
Excellent. So I wanted to chat about your most recent record. I saw that you did a live record in 2019 that was released in 2020, Sounds of the Seasons. And I was in collaboration with the Chicago Staff Band.
So forgot all about that. That's awesome.
So because it's a live record, how is it making this art and how is it kind of different from being in the studio and how is it working with that band?
You know what? That was a live performance. That was a show and they captured it and they released it. So that was actually not even, I remember being there and they said, can we record this? And I said, sure. So it wasn't something that was on my mind at all during it. I was collaborating on some of my songs with a brass band, which I had never done because I'd never played in that configuration in my life. It's a rare thing. It's a rare, very cool thing. Obviously, I play the trombone, so it was really special for me because they were all horn players. And it's amazing how orchestral it can sound, even without any strings. So that was really just a live performance that was recorded as and they released it for their album. And I was a guest on that. I will say, though, most of the time when I record an album, I am playing live. I don't really record in the traditional pop sense where we track, you know, drums first, then bass, then piano, then vocals where we comp everything. I'm usually singing like an entire take and, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself, but we did that for Where the Sunshine is Expensive as well. You know, because that's just, I'm a jazz artist, even though the songs are pop songs structurally for the most part, I still play jazz most of the time and we kind of record it just the same way we play it. So it never feels all that different to me unless, you know, the surroundings are different, which again, don't matter too much because every show, the surroundings are different anyway.
Definitely. So let's get into your previous album then. Where the Sunshine is Expensive debuted at number one on Billboard Contemporary Jazz charts. And so what all came together to make this album and what makes that one so special in your canon?
Oh, that was a special one because we recorded it live at East West Studios in Hollywood with an audience in the room and cameras on everything. So we have it all captured. If people go on YouTube and look for those songs, they're going to see the actual moment it was recorded exactly as they're watching it. So it made it special because fans actually came. Some of them flew in and were in the room with us. So it was really special. And I'm really glad we captured it. I'm really glad we got to actually have that moment forever and we'll never lose it. And, you know, musicians never love recording because later you're always like, oh, I could have done that better. Especially in a live setting where you don't redo anything. But it was special. I had written most of those songs except for, I think I did two covers on that album, maybe three. And we had done most of those on the road before we actually recorded. So it was really like a band doing a band recording what we had been playing live around the world. And the culmination of it was that record. And then of course we kept on performing it live afterwards, which was even more special because we had finally a product to sell.
Yeah, it's an interesting process when you're recording live. That reminds me of kind of the stuff I've seen with Snarky Puppy and a bunch of other groups, but
right.
When you're recording like that, you do get that audience feedback, which you don't get necessarily in the studio. But then you also, especially being video recorded, realize that there's a camera in your face and how you look is going to translate onto that. So was that kind of different at all just because of your live experience in general? And we'll talk about that too. You know, you just kind of like, I would be the same in any
Yeah, environment. I think I just don't, I try lately to not even I treat the camera like it might be another person if it's a live setting. And then if it's a recording session, I just kind of pretend it's not there, but I'm still expressing visibly. I do that alone. So I don't really differentiate how it feels. No, I really do try not to.
Awesome. Now, in your career, you have shared the stage with some amazing acts. So just a few of them. I've seen that you've done stuff with Alabama Shakes and Meghan Trainor and Pharrell Williams and Josh Groban, the Commodores and the Boston Pops in your bio. And so how does it feel to have worked with so many great musicians?
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I'm grateful. I've been able to be on festivals with these kinds of people and watch them and then go on stage right after them and or before them. And I've been able to perform with some of my musical heroes. Dave Koz is one of them who I've actually toured with pretty extensively now. I know I'm not the only one who would say that musicians learn from other musicians and we almost feed off each other. It is live music truly is a conversation, not just a performance. So, you know, there are a lot of good artists out there and I've just been really blessed to be able to meet many of them and watch them work and work with them. So I wouldn't trade it for anything. And it's fed my creativity for sure.
And yes, I've seen, posters of you performing with Dave Koz. You were on an album with Dave Koz and you got to fulfill a childhood lifelong dream of performing with Gloria Estefan as well with Dave Koz covering Conga. So how was it working with those legends and making that kind of magic happen?
The crazy part is I didn't even meet Gloria. She recorded her part in Miami after I recorded mine. And I remember being home after we had recorded the album with Dave and my other heroes, Gerald Albright on sax and Rick Braun on trumpet and Richard Elliott and who else was with us? Oh, so many good people. And I was home, like, just minding my own business. I think it was Passover and Easter was coming up. And I'm like, well, it's a holiday. Nobody's going to call me today. And Dave Koz calls me on the phone and it's Passover. And I'm kind of going, aren't you supposed to be like at dinner right now or something? And he goes, oh, no, Gloria Estefan wants to just sing backup on that track with you. And I'm going, what? What are you talking about? And yeah, she added that beautiful, buttery, smooth, slightly raspy voice to it. And I heard her take afterwards. She didn't even sing any lead lines, but her voice was coming through so beautifully and clearly because I mean, I could recognize that anywhere. Yeah. So that was pretty beautiful.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's so nice how those things kind of happen, but obviously you have to have the chops, you know, that make someone gravitate to one of be on a track that you're doing lead on. So that's amazing. And so I also saw you have been fronting, you know, with other bands. You did a lot of work with the Postmodern Jukebox.
Oh yeah.
Scott Bradley, I mean, hugely successful, way larger audience. I know they've had residencies in Vegas and other stuff. And so we spoke actually earlier on the podcast with Sarah Nimitz, who's done some work with them. Yay. As well. A friend of ours, Jacob, plays saxophone with them too. And so super excited. I just wanted to know, like, I know you think of Scott as a friend and a colleague, as a musician, have a lot of respect for him, but how was it working with PMJ and like, what was your experience with Scott?
I mean, PMJ is a party in a half. Like, it is the most, well, I feel like when I'm in the room with other PMJ artists, I am the most subdued, muted, introverted, quiet, and collected person on the planet because there are some characters in that conglomerate and some of them have become my best friends. They're consummate professionals. Everyone could fulfill any role on Broadway in that group. And yet they don't, because they're writing their own stuff and doing their own shows. And on Broadway, you have to do what they tell you. So that's sort of how I would describe it. And so I've had some of the best times of my life on tour with Ariana Savalas and Sarah. I mean, I've roomed with Sarah many times. She's a hoot. We're all a bunch of nerds, Sarah especially. And
yes.
We just have a ball. So Scott Bradley, who founded the group, he, as if people aren't familiar, he takes modern pop songs or just mega, you know, hits and turns them into old school, like old, more old school than my stuff, like 20s jazz for the most part. Or he'll do like a doo-wop version of a Miley Cyrus song or something. And the first time I ever worked with him, I knew, I was like, listen, I was telling myself this. I was like, this is my chance here. I'm coming in with an arrangement because I don't know if I'll ever have this opportunity again. So I walked in with this like idea for Bad Blood, and I wrote a bass line and a new melody and a few hits. And then Scott changed some of the chords, did put his arrangement stamp on it, and we collaborated on that. And after that, I went on tour with them pretty extensively and did a lot more videos. Scott's really cool. He works with so many different singers of different, just coming from different backgrounds, coming from different, different schools. And so I can't speak for them because working with Scott is very personalized. It depends on who he's working with. Sometimes he'll, you know, arrange music from the whole, you know, he'll do the whole thing. If a singer comes in and doesn't want to arrange anything or doesn't like to or anything. And then I walk in, I'm like, here's my idea, Scott. And he works with me. So he kind of, everybody's going to have a different experience with Scott. Or sometimes I walk in and I'm like, I don't want to do anything. What are we doing today, Scott? You know? So he's, and I can't thank him enough for introducing me to his audience and just his support. He's always been supportive. Every time I release something on my own, he'll listen and he'll share it. And I it's really a wonderful thing. And I have so much respect for him.
I love that. I love that people support each other on their individual projects. And yeah, I mean, he's worked with so many great people, and I've seen, you know, even Wayne Brady did a song with them. And it's interesting how they approach different things. And Sarah talked about it and some other people, and hopefully I'll get to talk to him one day about his kind of process. Everybody's process is different. And I've done, you know, 30, 40 interviews like this, and I learned something different from each person. Now, I saw also years ago you were in the Urban Renewal Project, and I love Urban Renewal, URP. Alex Nestor, we've had on the show, and I've worked with.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Yeah, and some of the horn players have been horn players in my group too. And so is it different fronting and like a bigger group like that, I mean, especially like a huge 15-piece big band, and also since you double on vocal and trombone, how do you kind of approach that type of situation?
I don't really. You have to eat the microphone with a group that plays loud funk. That's just hard. And it's okay. You just go in knowing I'm not going to have a lot of subtlety here, and anything I do that's subtle here is not going to translate. And that's okay, because this is music that is in your face, and that's what you do. You know, one of my Urban Renewal Project, it's a wall of sound, you know, and in the studio, I did some recordings with them, and it was really fun because, you know, in the studio, you can manipulate everything to sound the way you want it. And obviously mixing, the vocals come out quite easily when you have all that control. And then on a live show, it's like, you know what, everybody's here to dance. Everybody's here to bop around. And I'm not going to pretend that they're going to listen to me whisper something here. And that's fun. And that's fine. And it was one of the first gigs I ever had when I moved to LA from Boston. I'll never forget it. RW was very kind to have me on the bandstand. And it was wonderful.
Yes, lots and lots and lots of talent in that group. And just being able to have a group of that size moving around is a feat in itself. And so I don't know if this comparison will make sense to you. I hope that it does. But in my eyes, listening to your music, I view you, you're equally as talented on trombone as in singing, which is not always the case. And it reminds me of a female version of like a Louis Armstrong or Nat King Cole, where like they were like prolific musicians and vocalists, even though they kind of became more known for their vocals than their music, especially like a person like Nat King Cole over the years. Do you feel like your vocals outshine your playing in some way, or do they remain equal, at least to you and in your heart?
You know, they do, but that's okay with me. I am a singer first. I learned how to sing first. The trombone is way harder. I think I do sing better than I play. it's more natural for me. And some people have the opposite story. I know a lot of horn players that kind of learn to sing after. So that's just how it was for me. That's how it worked for me. I got my start in musical theater and then singing, and then I started playing the trombone. The trombone, however, introduced me to jazz. So before that, it was all pop and musical theater. And I really did become a jazz singer after I became a jazz trombone player. So that was the sequence of events there. But thank you for that comparison. I mean, I get a lot, man, trombone and voice, that's a weird combination. And I'll go, is it though? Because Louis Armstrong. It's not that weird. It's been happening for, I'm not doing anything new. And I have to credit people like him for making that normal. And, you know, it's the music of New Orleans. It's call and response. You call with your voice, you respond with your horn, or vice versa. And it's beautiful and it's natural and it's human. I'm just blessed I get to do it, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Right. Yeah. I was told that Nat King Cole wasn't a singer at all. I believe he was on a gig where the owner of the club they were playing said, which one of you is the singer? And he said, we're just a trio. We play just music. Yeah. And they said, well, if someone doesn't sing, you're not getting paid. So he just started.
Yeah.
It was interesting how that happened.
It is. And a lot of instrumentalists can sing just fine. They just haven't tried. You know, obviously Nat King Cole sings a lot better than just fine.
Oh yeah. I mean, I guess I could have thrown George Benson into that mix too. I think he has
absolutely a voice
and player. And I love the way he sings his solos and stuff too.
Yeah.
So a little bit more about your origin story then, since you were talking about kind of musical theater in the beginning. It's like, how did you originally, like, where are you from? And like, how did you originally figure out like music could be my thing?
I'm from Seattle, the Seattle area. I'm from a town about 35 minutes northeast of Seattle called Snohomish. And my parents are both music teachers. They met teaching band and choir at a junior high school in Redmond, Washington. And yes, they married each other. And that was probably not allowed, but they did. And I came out of that. My parents are great. My dad's a fabulous trumpet player. My mom's a wonderful singer. They both are gifted teachers. Not a lot of musicians are. And they always were, teenagers were always coming in out of our house, just taking lessons with my parents. I never took a private lesson with my parents. Cause you know, when you're 10, you're like, leave me alone, dad. I don't hear from you, you know, but there's a lot more that's caught than taught. And I caught good musical taste from them. The reason I have such eclectic taste is because of my parents. They would play Whitney Houston, Beethoven, Celine Dion, Stevie Wonder, Barbara Streisand, the Spice Girls, and the Eagles, all in a matter of an hour. And I just thought that was normal. Because when you're a kid, you think whatever you're fed is normal.
Right.
And I didn't realize that wasn't normal till later in life, you know? And so I was blessed by that. And I started singing and emulating these singers that my parents would play. You know, I'd be 3 years old, 4 years old, trying to sing just like them. And I could. So I just had the need to sing. We didn't live in Nashville or LA or New York. We didn't have things to audition for that were TV or songwriting or whatever. But there was a strong musical theater situation going on in the Seattle area. So I would sing at church on Sundays and then go and audition for musical theater productions during the week, and I would get these child roles. So I kind of got my start doing that. And I learned how to work hard. I learned how to memorize lines. I learned how to do a show. I learned how to complete something at a very young age. And I had my first job when I was like 10, paid job. And my mom would take me down to Seattle, and this 35 minutes down, and I'd go to rehearsal. I'd miss a lot of school and get a tutor and learn, you know, make up for stuff. And then when I was, you know, in middle school, I wanted to be back with my friends. So I quit that, picked up a trombone because I wanted to be so cool, and learned how to play jazz on the trombone. And then, you know, started singing that way. And then I went to Berklee College of Music. I did the Montreux Jazz Festival. I won the vocal competition at that, and just kind of kept on going and moved to LA after I got married. And gosh, we set up shop there, and
I just started doing my own shows for 5 people and for 10 people and then for 12 people and then for the Hollywood Bowl one day. And it didn't happen like that. It just eventually happened like that.
Yeah, I saw that you had played the Hollywood Bowl. I know you'd also done iconic venues like Ronnie Scott's in London. I love the Ella Live at That's Ronnie Scott's. And so, what's the most exciting venue or memorable performance you've had and why?
You know, it might be Ronnie Scott's. I had pneumonia when I played Radio City, and I was like telling myself, don't be sick right now. and I did the show. The adrenaline got me through, and then I collapsed and went to the hospital after and got all better later. But
the show must go on.
I mean, that's a memory if I get to have a memory. And Ronnie Scott's is cool because I know that, well, Louis Armstrong, Buddy Rich, Ella Fitzgerald, mm-hmm. they all played in there. And the place looks just like it did in the 60s. That's dope. So I love playing Ronnie Scott's because I feel like I'm there with the guys in the 60s when it first came out, except, you know, they don't smoke in there anymore, thankfully. But, you know, I just imagine it's full of smoke and I'm Frank Sinatra and I'm playing Ronnie Scott's.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so many people are great on stage. I saw Jacob Collier on an interview talking about how when Prince came to play Ronnie Scott's, and he was, I think, too young or just didn't go. And he was like, that's one of the concerts he wished he had seen. But it's an amazing place. Is there anyone you haven't worked with that you would like to?
Oh, so many. There's like 40 million. I mean, I would like to work with Snarky Puppy. I would like to work with Wolfpack. I would like to work with, there's countless people I would like to work with. But those are a few. I'd like to work with Melody Gardot someday. I mean, this loud woman go meet with this subdued, like, beautiful, small but powerful voice, we might be able to make something work, you know.
yes I believe she
timbre differences and stuff.
She can't do loud sounds. I guess some kind of injury she had, so
right. But it doesn't matter because she sounds so compelling.
I love the hushed whisper tones. Her her album My Only Thrill, I think it's called, it's amazing. And her subsequent ones too.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
So what's next musically for you?
Well, I have an album in the can. Just finished recording it. We are getting it mastered as we speak. Yeah, getting it mastered as we speak. So I'll release a single in February. I'll release a single in March. I'll release a single in April. And I believe the album will be out in May. So everybody can be on the lookout for that. They can find it on aubreylogan.com. They can find all the information for anything there, including, you know, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, all that stuff. And so the album is the jazziest one yet. I will say that. That's what I will give away for now. It's the jazziest one yet.
Nice. Well, that's got to be fun.
It was. I recorded it in Austin. Everything is one take. There was no audience. We don't really have those these days. But
right.
It was special. And I'm really excited to share it.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to being able to hear it. So as we start to kind of wrap up, we have a few rapid fire questions, but super important, I think, for our audience.
Yeah.
Two of them. One is, what advice would you give a newbie in music starting out today?
Put your pride away and just get in front of whoever you can and just go for it. Say yes to everything and don't be afraid of things to go slow, of things to be difficult, and be okay with some adversity.
Yeah. I mean, you can't get into the music business and not be primed for adversity and rejection and just really, really keeping your mind, in the positive energy space. Yeah. And then what do you want your musical legacy to be? And I know that you're super young and you have so many, 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 many years ahead. Like a Tony Bennett, you know, I want you in your 90s to still be on stage and doing it. What do you think, though, when it's all said and done, if you could remember for one thing musically, what would you want that to be?
Man, you know, one of the coolest moments I ever had was being on stage at a show once. And I looked out in the audience, and it was an outdoor show, so I could see everyone because there were no dark lights. It was light out. And I saw a 10-year-old, maybe 10-year-old looking boy high-five his grandpa at my show. And I thought, that's what I want. I want multiple generations to always want to come, and that it's never one age group at my show or listening to my records. And I want that to continue because I know that there are, you know, folks over 50, over 60, over 80 listening to my stuff. And I find that to be such an honor because they have good taste. And then there are somebody's kid, somebody's granddaughter, somebody's little girl playing the trombone in her middle school band who wants to listen to the music. And that's wonderful. And I want that to be my legacy. I want my music to be for everybody.
And you definitely have that. I mean, you're doing so many cool things and it's so fresh and so innovative, yet, you know, definitely strong roots in jazz. And I think jazz is not dead. You know, a lot of people, we have some great people out there right now, really championing it. Kamasi Washington and
yes.
Starkey Puppy and Wolfpack and people you named and Scott Bradley and their group. I mean, it's just great to see the energy of that. The jazz, I mean, it's influenced hip hop, it's influenced American culture, and it's here to stay. But it's not just art music, it's not just classical music. It's meant to be improvisational and alive still.
And because of that, there's so much room for it to grow and change and evolve, and it always has. And when you say jazz, you have no idea. I mean, that doesn't mean that's not specific at all.
No, not at all. I mean, it could be literally.
Literally, I think.
Anything. And then people debate over it. I mean, you have the purists, the non-purists. I love Herbie, and I love Herbie's like fusion funk stuff in the 70s. And then you have people like the Marsalis brothers. They're like, this is not jazz, you know, even though those sold
millions. I'm no purist at all.
Yeah, it's hard to be unless you're doing super, super straight ahead. I mean, if you're doing anything that's fusion or hybrid, then.
Yeah, and I like I mentioned, this will be the most straight ahead album I've ever done, but. And it was sure fun, but I'm no purist.
So then as we start to wrap up, I just want to make sure that where can people find you again? Give us all the hits for social media and website.
AubreyLogan.com will take you to all the following things. So just remember that, AubreyLogan.com. But there's Instagram is Aubrey_Logan and Facebook.com/AubreyLoganMusic, YouTube.com/AubreyLoganMusic. And they can find me on Spotify and Apple Music and Deezer and Tidal and wherever the nerds are, they can find me.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, literally anywhere you can find her on streaming platform. That's awesome. And so what should they, if I was a person and I was like, okay, she sounds dope, I want to go check her out. What should they listen to first? What do you recommend for you first?
I think they should listen to Where the Sunshine is Expensive. I think they should listen to that one.
Yeah, well, I've listened to it this last weekend. I love it, and I definitely will continue to listen to it. But Aubrey, so excited to be able to have you on Deeper Grooves Podcast today. We will definitely circle back to your management team when it's all said and done and out. You can have links to everything, and we'll be keeping track on your illustrious career and the new album that's going to be your jazziest yet, hopefully to come soon. And we definitely want to keep in touch and see how things are going up the road.
Thank you, Cliff. I appreciate you. Thanks for chatting with me today.
You are so welcome. We'll talk soon. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, everyone. You just tuned in to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I had a blast talking with Aubrey Logan, the dually talented trombonist and vocalist whose latest album, Where the Sunshine is Expensive, debuted at number one on the Billboard Contemporary Jazz Charts. Definitely go check it out on all streaming platforms. You can also check her out at AubreyLogan.com. I would like to also thank our engineer, Tim Hall, in 1192 Studios for mixing and mastering this recording today. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves or anchor.fm/deepergrooves. Until then, stay jazzy. Love the music. Love the life you're living. We'll talk to you soon.